The emotional sum that struck her as an immediate impression of Francisco's house when she entered it for the first time was not the sum she had once drawn from the sight of its silent, locked exterior. She felt not a sense of tragic loneliness, but of invigorating brightness. The rooms were bare and crudely simple. The house seemed built with the skill, the decisiveness, and the impatience typical of Francisco. It looked like a frontiersman's shanty thrown together to serve as a mere springboard for a long flight into the future. A future where so great a field of activity lay waiting that no time could be wasted on the comfort of its start. The place had the brightness not of a home, but of a fresh wooden scaffolding erected to shelter the birth of a skyscraper. Francisco, in shirt sleeves, stood in the middle of his 12-foot square living room, with the look of a host in a palace. Of all the places where she had ever seen him, this was the background that seemed most properly his. Just as the simplicity of his clothes, added to his bearing, gave him the air of a superlative aristocrat, so the crudeness of the room gave it the appearance of the most patrician retreat. A single royal touch was added to the crudeness. Two ancient silver goblets stood in a small niche cut in a wall of bare logs. Their ornate design had required the luxury of some craftsman's long and costly labor, more labor than had gone to build the shanty, a design dimmed by the polish of more centuries than had gone to grow the log wall's pines. In the midst of that room, Francisco's easy, natural manner had a touch of quiet pride, as if his smile were silently saying to her, "This is what I am, and what I have been all these years." She looked up at the silver goblets. "Yes," he said in answer to her silent guess. "They belong to Sebastian Donconia and his wife. That's the only thing I brought here from my palace in Buenos Aires. That and the crest over the door. It's all I wanted to save. Everything else will go in a very few months now." He chuckled. "They'll seize it, all of it. The last dregs of Donconia copper, but they'll be surprised. They won't find much for their trouble. And as to that palace, they won't be able to afford even its heating bill." "And then?" she asked. "Where will you go from there?"
I will go to work for Donconia copper."
"What do you mean? Do you remember that old slogan? The king is dead, long live the king. When the carcass of my ancestors' property is out of the way, then my mine will become the young new body of Donconia copper, the kind of property my ancestors had wanted, had worked for, had deserved, but had never owned."
"Your mine?"
"What mine? Where?"
"Here,"
he said, pointing toward the mountain peaks.
"Didn't you know it?"
"No.
I own a copper mine that the looters won't reach. It's here in these mountains.
I did the prospecting. I discovered it. I broke the first excavation. It was over 8 years ago. I was the first man to whom Midas sold land in this valley. I bought that mine. I started it with my own hands, as Sebastian Donconia had started. I have a superintendent in charge of it now who used to be my best metallurgist in Chile. The mine produces all the copper we require. My profits are deposited at the Mulligan Bank. That will be all I'll have a few months from now. That will be all I'll need." "To conquer the world," was the way his voice sounded on his last sentence. And she marveled at the difference between that sound and the shameful, mawkish tone, half whine, half threat, the tone of beggar and thug combined which the men of their century had given to the word need. "Dagny," he was saying, standing at the window, as if looking out at the peaks, not of mountains, but of time. "The rebirth of Donconia copper and of the world has to start here, in the United States. This country was the only country in history born not of chance and blind tribal warfare, but as a rational product of man's mind. This country was built on the supremacy of reason, and for one magnificent century it redeemed the world. It will have to do so again. The first step of Donconia copper, as of any other human value, has to come from here, because the rest of the earth has reached the consummation of the beliefs it has held through the ages. Mystic faith, the supremacy of the irrational, which has but two monuments at the end of its course, the lunatic asylum and the graveyard. Sebastian Donconia committed one error. He accepted a system which declared that the property he had earned by right was to be his not by right, but by permission. His descendants paid for that error. I've made the last payment. I think that I will see the day when, growing out from their root in this soil, the mines, the smelters, the ore docks of Donconia copper will spread again through the world and down to my native country,
and I will be the first to start my country's rebuilding. I may see it, but I cannot be certain. No man can predict the time when others will choose to return to reason. It may be that at the end of my life I shall have established nothing but this single mine, Donconia Copper No. 1, Galt's Gulch, Colorado, USA. But, Dagny, do you remember that my ambition was to double my father's production of copper? Dagny, if at the end of my life I produce but 1 pound of copper a year, I will be richer than my father, richer than all my ancestors with all their thousands of tons, because that 1 pound will be mine by right and will be used to maintain a world that knows it. This was the Francisco of their childhood, in bearing and manner, in the unclouded brilliance in his eyes, and she found herself questioning him about his copper mine, as she had questioned him about his industrial projects on their walks on the shore of the Hudson, recapturing the sense of an unobstructed future. "I'll take you to see the mine," he said, "as soon as your ankle recovers completely. We have to climb a steep trail to get there, just a mule trail. There's no truck road as yet. Let me show you the new smelter I'm designing. I've been working on it for some time. It's too complex for our present volume of production, but when the mine's output grows to justify it, just take a look at the time, labor, and money that it will save." They were sitting together on the floor, bending over the sheets of paper he spread before her, studying the intricate sections of the smelter, with the same joyous earnestness they had once brought to the study of scraps in a junkyard. She leaned forward just as he moved to reach for another sheet, and she found herself leaning against his shoulder. Involuntarily, she held still for one instant, no longer than for a small break in the flow of a single motion, while her eyes rose to his. He was looking down at her, neither hiding what he felt nor implying any further demand. She drew back, knowing that she had felt the same desire as his. Then, still holding the recaptured sensation of what she had felt for him in the past, she grasped a quality that had always been part of it, now suddenly clear to her for the first time. If that desire was a celebration of one's life, then what she had felt for Francisco had always been a celebration of her future, like a moment of splendor gained in part payment of an unknown total, affirming some promise to come. In the instant when she grasped it, she knew also the only desire she had ever experienced, not in token of the future, but of the full and final present. She knew it by means of an image. The image of a man's figure standing at the door of a small granite structure. The final form of the promise that had kept her moving, she thought, was the man who would perhaps remain a promise never to be reached. But this, she thought in consternation, was that view of human destiny which she had most passionately hated and rejected, the view that man was ever to be drawn by some vision of the unattainable shining ahead, doomed ever to aspire, but not to achieve. Her life and her values could not bring her to that, she thought. She had never found beauty in longing for the impossible, and had never found the possible to be beyond her reach. But she had come to it, and she could find no answer. She could not give him up, or give up the world, she thought, looking at Galt that evening. The answer seemed harder to find in his presence. She felt that no problem existed, that nothing could stand beside the fact of seeing him, and nothing would ever have the power to make her leave, and simultaneously, that she would have no right to look at him if she were to renounce her railroad. She felt that she owned him, that the unnamed had been understood between them from the start, and simultaneously, that he was able to vanish from her life and on some future street of the outside world to pass her by in unweighted indifference. She noted that he did not question her about Francisco. When she spoke of her visit, she could find no reaction in his face, neither of approval nor of resentment. It seemed to her that she caught an imperceptible shading in his gravely attentive expression. He looked as if this were a matter about which he did not choose to feel. Her faint apprehension grew into a question mark, and the question mark turned into a drill, cutting deeper and deeper into her mind through the evenings that followed, when Galt left the house and she remained alone. He went out every other night after dinner, not telling her where he went, returning at midnight or later. She tried not to allow herself fully to discover with what tension and restlessness she waited for his return. She did not ask him where he spent his evenings. The reluctance that stopped her was her too urgent desire to know. She kept silent in some dimly intentional form of defiance, half in defiance of him, half of her own anxiety.